a full room today and an overflow room. We are going to start today the meeting measures, yes. We will open a work session for measure introduction. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move LC 1960, LC 1959, LC 1958, I see I'm taking these in reverse order, LC 1437, and LC 1983 all be introduced as committee bills.
Senator,
with the caveat that doesn't mean I support them.
Senator Beyer, with that caveat, has introduced the aforementioned, has moved that the aforementioned LCs be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Okay, now we will open a brief work session on Senate Bill 84, the Scrivener's Bill. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 84 comes to you at the request of the Senate Interjudiciary Committee for the Office of Legislative Counsel. Makes non-substantive and technical changes to Oregon law, corrects grammar and punctuation, deletes obsolete provisions, conforms language to existing statutes, and legislative style.
Okay, committee, we had this bill before us. This is the revisor's bill. I deliberately did not work it that very day because I wanted to give anybody who might have a chance to have a problem with any of the details a chance to find them. Nobody has found anything. So, Senator Beyer, at this time I would appreciate a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 84 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 84 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this?
I'd love to.
We all thought you would.
I'll find some really juicy thing there to read about.
Okay. I want to tell the assembled here how appreciative we are on Judiciary to have Senator Brown joining us today to discuss some of the bills on the agenda. She's been a member of the work group on these bills and has worked very, very hard all interim to develop a very impressive product. So thank you, Senator Brown.
Thank you for having me.
We have another member of the work group who wants to testify on Senate Bill 282. So in order to give him time to get here, Representative Krieger, I'm going to start with a public hearing on the next bill on our list, which is Senate Bill 320, which only has two witnesses signed up. So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 320. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 320 comes here at the request of the Senate Interjudiciary Committee for the Oregon Law Commission sets forth standards and procedures for determining if a youth in a delinquency matter is unfit to proceed as a result of mental disease or defect.
Okay. We have Julie McFarland, Tom Cleary, and Sam Sears signed up.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Senator Brown.
Thank you. While they're coming forward, I just, for the committee's information, Senate Bills 320, 325, and 328 are Oregon Law Commission bills, and they are all the product of the Juvenile Code Rewrite Committee, which I chair. This committee's been, I think this is eighth year we've been meeting. It's a group of 40 to 50 lawyers, juvenile court workers, DAs, judges that meet every other month to improve our juvenile code. So this is one of the bills that is the product of our work group. So I just really appreciate the committee's time and energy and willingness to hear these bills.
Thank you, Senator Brown, and we appreciate your work. You're vice chair of the commission, and you've been on a number of years. Are you chair by now?
No, I actually resigned from my vice chairmanship, chairwomanship.
Well, you're still vice chair in my mind.
Thank you, Senator Burdick.
We appreciate all your hard work. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, Sam Sears, the Oregon Law Commission. I'd just like to say a few brief words about the Oregon Law Commission. I think all the committee members are quite familiar with the commission. It was established in 97 by the Legislative Assembly to conduct a continuous program of law reform. It's made up of 13 commissioners that represent all three branches of the government, the law schools, and private practice. And the Law Commission is comes to you with recommendations that you can ultimately make the policy determinations. and we attempt to bring about nonpartisan reform that creates good law for Oregon, assembling all the stakeholders in the given area, and that's what we have done with these bills here, or attempted to do. With that said, I'd like to briefly talk about Senate Bill 320. Committee Council has described that bill for you, and I would just like to say a few broad overview statements and then let the two people who are to my right talk about it in a little more detail. Currently, under Oregon law, there's no statutory provisions for juvenile fitness to proceed issues to be raised. So that is when a juvenile is attempting to raise a fitness to proceed issue, they're handled somewhat inconsistently in the courts. There currently are adult provisions for this to happen. And just to briefly describe, a fitness to proceed is a constitutional right that a defendant would have, an adult defendant or a juvenile would have. That's basically being able to assist counsel or understand the nature of the proceedings against the juvenile. So Senate Bill 320 establishes substantive provisions regarding fitness to proceed, and it also sets out procedural provisions for these proceedings if when a juvenile does raise fitness to proceed issues. Now, with that said, I'd like to introduce the two individuals to my right. They were co-chairs for the work group of the Fitness to Proceed Project, Tom Cleary, who is a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County, and Julie McFarlane, who's a staff attorney for the Juvenile Rights Project.
Good afternoon, Senator Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Julie McFarlane, and I am a supervising attorney of the Juvenile Rights Project. I was co-chair with Tom Cleary of the District Attorney's Office on the sub-work group, which was a fairly large and well-attended sub-work group, and we set out to provide some procedures and standards in statute that we have not had prior to this for the question of aid and assist or unfitness to proceed in a juvenile delinquency proceeding. These issues have been raised in juvenile delinquency proceedings, and that has been based on constitutional law and loosely guided by that constitutional law. But because there has not been anything in the juvenile code, there have been problems in those cases. One of the problems, of course, is that we get inconsistent results because we have different judges not being guided by specific statutory provisions and not being sure about interpretations of constitutional law, which is primarily a law that has developed in the adult arena and not in the juvenile arena, and so that has been a problem for us, and it also has been a problem that once youth are found incompetent, we have no procedure or system for restoration or how to deal with an unfit youth in this context. So that is what Senate Bill 320 does, is it provides a standard to determine unfitness to proceed. It provides procedures for that determination by the court, and it provides the resources and further procedures once unfitness is determined to either have the youth restored or to proceed with the case. There have been more of these motions being filed in recent years because of the Supreme Court's decision in Roper, and there's been more attention to this issue for juveniles, and so it is particularly important that we proceed now and have a statutory framework for which to bring these cases. I think we believe that it is both in the state's interest and in the defense's interest to have this bill passed, and we did have good representation from both prosecution and defense on our work group. From the defense's perspective, we want to have clear standards and procedures. From the district attorney's perspective, without restorative services, there often is a question of what happens with those cases once an unfitness decision is made. And I think that's all I have, and I'll turn it over to Tom Cleary.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, I'm Tom Cleary. I'm the Senior Deputy District Attorney in Multnomah County, and I have the pleasure of co-chairing this committee with Ms. McFarlane. And I agree with what Ms. McFarlane has said. This is a good product that gives us statutory procedures to follow in the event that we have an unable to assist motion filed. Very careful detail was also taken in the crafting of this piece of legislation to make sure that we were doing everything possible to help the youth, to either restore the youth or diagnose the youth with the difficulties that the youth is experiencing. Obviously, that's beneficial for the youth, but it's also beneficial for the victims of crime because we move the cases through the system quickly and bring some finality to these things.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this substantially different from adult proceedings, and if so, how?
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz, it is different in the sense of how we deal with a individual or a youth who stands accused of a crime, and that's because of the different treatment possibilities that are available for a youth that are not available for the adult side.
So from that perspective, there's a difference, but as far as findings, it's basically the same sort of procedure.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Senator Byer. Oh, Senator Brown. Senator Byer is watching after your interests there.
Thank you, Madam Chair, if I may. Mr. Cleary, I guess my question is, I had a meeting with Mr. Bradbury and folks from the District Attorneys Association. They expressed some concerns with the legislation. Have you had an opportunity to talk with them, and are they copacetic with this bill as written?
Madam Chair, Senator Brown, I have had a brief email exchange on Friday afternoon, and I do not know the position of the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Cleary, if you had a juvenile who's before the adult court, say for a Measure 11 offense, and they were unable to aid and assist, would they go under the adult system, or would they go under this bill?
Madam Chair, Mr. Taylor, yes, I believe that they would go under the adult system. ORS 137-700, which deals with ballot Measure 11, has built within it an automatic remand, so youth 15 and older go automatically into the adult system.
And they would not be under this bill?
I'm sorry.
And they would not be under this bill, is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Madeline Olson and Bill Buska. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Madeline Olson, the Deputy Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services for Addiction and Mental Health Services. And with me this afternoon is Bill Buska, who is our manager for Children's Services and was a member of the subcommittee that worked on this bill. I'm here today to testify on Senate Bill 320. As you've heard, it would define a youth's fitness to proceed, or lack thereof, and establish the procedures and substantive rules regarding the raising of these issues, as well as obtaining evaluations, challenging the evaluations, and then administering the restorative services. We worked closely with the Oregon Law Commission and the Juvenile Code Revision Work Group during the interim, and were very supportive of the concepts in this bill, and believe that both youth who may not be able to aid and assist in their defense will benefit from its provisions. the department's position is neutral because there is a cost associated with the administrative structure and the actual payment for restorative services. And we were clear about that during our work with the Juvenile Code Revision Work Group. And those costs at this point are not included in the governor's recommended budget, and therefore we're taking a neutral stance. The work that we will do under this bill will be sure that there's a system for evaluating these youths, that the evaluators meet a set of standards and competencies, that there's training for the evaluators. And then, in addition, we'll set up the structures and the administration for a system of contractors to provide the restorative services. And I think one of the really important things about this is that the services will be provided where the youth is located, whenever that's possible, in terms of serving the youth best. The other thing that's important about this is that the restorative services are distinct from any mental health treatment that some of the youth may require. And those individual contractors that provide the restorative services would link any of the youth requiring mental health treatment to the existing treatment system. With that, again, we're supportive of the bill, but without this small amount of additional funding that's required, would not be able to fulfill our departmental responsibilities. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify and stand ready to answer questions.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madeline, I mean, I see the dollar figure you have here. Are you also looking at additional FTE to accomplish this?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz. The dollar figure includes $480,000 to pay for the restorative services. We estimate, I think, about 40 youth per year will need that. The remainder, which is around $163,000, would be one position to set up all of the rule requirements and the structures to both train, certify the evaluators, provide a list of certified evaluators to the courts, contract for the restorative services, set up the structures for that, the appeal processes, and things like that.
So Madam Chair, so one FTE or one and a quarter?
It's one with the services and supplies and supports travel expenses and things like that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would just ask a follow-up on Senator Cruz's question, and in terms of the fiscal impact, can we assume at this point in time that there are no restorative services being offered to the youth in the system?
Madam Chair, Senator Brown, to the best of my knowledge, there are not, but I'm not knowledgeable enough to say that with certainty.
Okay. Thank you. Nothing further.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, that's it. Okay. We will close the public hearing. There's no one else signed up. Did anybody else want to talk on Senate Bill 320? Mr. Sears.
Senator Burdick, members of the committee. I did want to mention there are some amendments.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Sam Sears, the Oregon Law Commission. There are some amendments for this bill that the commission recommended. They are non-substantive type of amendments that just did not get done before the bill was filed.
Okay,
so we will put those in.
That. We're not going to move any of these bills today, so I appreciate you getting that on the record. Thank you. We will close the public.
Madam Chair, when the amendments come, Senator Brown went back to check, but I'd like to have, if there are concerns, if the DAs have concerns, it'd be nice to have them on the record.
That's correct, and I saw a DA.
Evan's here. He's in the middle aisle right
maybe
now.
Maybe drag him forward. Here. Mr. Neely,
or maybe by the time the amendments come, if they're not ready at this point, but
yeah.
Just
come on. He's paying attention.
Got to stay on your toes in this committee, Mr. Neely.
For the record, Kevin Neely, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The district attorneys are neutral on this bill.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you for getting that on the record, Ms. McNeely.
Thank you.
Okay. We will now close the public hearing on Senate Bill 320. And most of the people in the audience are signed up for Senate Bill 282. And my intention today is to get through that bill, get through the whole list of testimony today, which means it'll be important for people to keep their comments as brief as possible. Don't leave anything out, but don't feel if someone else makes your point, you don't have to repeat it. And we should be able to make it through all the witnesses. We have other bills on the agenda, and those will be put over to tomorrow if we don't get to them. But I'm hoping to make it all the way through 282 today. So with that, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 282. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 282 is at the request of Senate Interim Judiciary Committee for the Juvenile Rights Project. It's a very lengthy bill pertaining to dependency, among other things, amends the definition of foster care to allow a person related by blood or marriage to maintain a foster home, define sibling as two or more children. This is so that it'd be easier to have siblings together in a foster care home, and does about a dozen other things.
Okay. And then,
well said.
This bill is one of the products of the interim work group I mentioned earlier. We have two of those members on this panel, Senator Brown and Senator Cruz.
But it's not part of the work group.
It's not one of these.
We're working together.
Yes.
Working
yes.
together. Okay, excuse me, I misunderstood that. Representative Krieger will be coming shortly to testify on this bill, and when he comes, we'll put him on. But we will start for the moment with our first group of panelists, Angela Sherbo, Judge Nan Waller, Kay Turan, and Maggie Miller. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Angela Sherbo. I'm also a supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project, and I will attempt in very quickly to do what Mr. Taylor began, which is walk you through the bill. I'll let the other panelists introduce themselves, but I want to tell you I'm so honored to be sitting at this table with these other women. I have practiced juvenile and family law for 30 years. Judge Waller is the chief family and juvenile law judge in Multnomah County, and she has practiced juvenile law for many years and sat on the bench for many years. Maggie Miller is the executive director of the Citizens Crime Commission. That's an organization that deals with what happens when we don't provide these kind of services early on to children and youth. And Kay Turan is currently the president and chief executive officer of Volunteers of America of Oregon, and previously was the director of what was then called Services to Children and Families, previously known as CSD, and currently known, I believe, as DHS Child Welfare. This bill is the product of years and years of personal experience, the experience of scores of lawyers in the Juvenile Rights Project, of the experience of thousands of children that we represent and that these people serve. It's also the product of research. This is not just a bill that we thought up because our experiences tell us that something needs to be done. Our experience tells us actually the same thing as research tells us. Children do much better when they're placed with people they know, with relatives, with family, whether that's their family of origin, their adoptive family, their extended family. So we know that. The research tells us that. The research tells us the same thing about visitation. For children in foster care who visit with their parents, they are much more likely to return home and stay there successfully and safely. The research tells us that children who are visited by their caseworkers are much more likely to have successful outcomes than those children who never see the representative of the body, and that is all of us, the state, who is in fact their parent. So we took experience, we took research, and we collaborated. The first page of my testimony notes the number of people with whom we have spoken about this bill as it was in the drafting phases, and I'm one of two co-authors of the bill. And we have, you know, from the Citizens Crime Commission to the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we have the Oregon Association of Child and Adolescent Psychiatrists, we have judges, district attorneys. So we did a lot of groundwork before we got here. The very briefly, would you like me to pause, Chair?
No,
Chair
Burdick, go on ahead.
Very briefly, what the bill does is it takes three things that we know. We know placement with relatives and contact with relatives is good for children. And so what we've done in the bill is address that issue in a number of different ways. In the first section of the bill, we address the disparity in terms of foster care payments. At this point, the state of Oregon is one of two states that does not pay relatives who are certified, held to the same standards, held to the same requirements as non-relatives. We don't pay all of them. We pay some of them. Our bill would extend, would make a change in the substantive law definition of foster care provider such that all relatives would be paid. And as I think you know, and as the my testimony points out, there's another bill or a policy package in the governor's budget that would increase to some but not all relative foster providers that those benefits. So we remove the impediment to payment. We insert a policy statement in the juvenile code that emphasizes the importance of safeguarding and promoting children's rights to safety and well-being, but also to continuity of relationships with their parents, with their siblings, with their grandparents and other relatives. We add to the juvenile code a heightened requirement that DHS look for relatives and make placements with relatives. And at the very end of my testimony, I do want to address what is a somewhat controversial issue, I think, the definition of diligent efforts. But so we have payment, we have policy, we have an heightened obligation on the part of the state to place, and then the fourth piece of that is we change the statute, which addresses the court's authority to specify a type, but not specific, placement. And there's a slight amount of controversy with respect to that in terms of payment, and I'll address that also at the end. So we have relatives. The second big piece of the bill is taking, again, a look at what we know about visitation, placement stability, school stability in terms of outcomes for kids, building on what already exists, a relationship between the state agency that makes reports and to the court and the court that makes findings back. And that sort of symbiotic relationship is what informs all of us in the juvenile court community and the child welfare community about how each particular child is doing and allows us to focus our attention on those children who need it most. And for those children who are doing well, we're in the position, as Judge Waller often does, of congratulating everybody. And I want to make it really clear, there are so many incredibly hardworking, incredibly talented people on the bench, in the bar, and at DHS Child Welfare, and in the provider community who are working for these kids. Nobody does it for the money. And so while sometimes we disagree about policy, and sometimes we have differences with one another, there's no doubt that there's an enormous amount of goodwill, and I've appreciated all the help I've gotten as I've created this bill. The last piece in the bill has to do with a very small group of children. Those are children that the state has either actively or tacitly made orphans, either by proceeding to terminate the parents' rights or accepting the parents' relinquishments of those rights. And when that happens, those are the smaller group to whom we owe even a higher duty, a higher burden. And for those children, what the bill does is says it's not enough to have a permanency hearing about what's going to happen to that child and whether the efforts on behalf of that child have been sufficient once a year. Once a year is not enough for children that we have made legal orphans if things are not going well. So we do that at the end of the bill. Let me, before I take everyone's time, let me address very quickly the issue of diligent efforts and 4E funding. I want to read into the record, both for the purposes of history and just for clarification, the definitions from Webster's Third, from Black's Law Dictionary, and from the Random House Dictionary of the word diligent. From Webster's, diligent is characterized by steady, earnest, attentive, and energetic application and effort in a pursuit, vocation, or study. From Black's, attentive and persistent in doing a thing, steadily applied, active, sedulous, laborious, unremitting, untiring. And from Random House, constant in effort to accomplish something, attentive and persistent in doing anything, or done or pursued with preserving attention, painstaking. Those are the ordinary dictionary meanings of the word, which our Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court uses when interpreting statutory language. The other thing I will tell you is that diligent is not a new term, either to the Oregon statutes or even in particular to the statutes governing child welfare. The court currently makes a determination about whether diligent efforts have been made to find an absent parent in a dependency case before proceeding, and the juvenile court currently is required to find whether or not DHS has made diligent efforts to notify the family of a refugee child. So the courts have done and can interpret the term diligent. We intend diligent to be a standard in higher than reasonable and approaching but lower than active, which is in the Indian Child Welfare Act. The last thing, there's been some questions raised about whether using diligent in the context we use it and the statute where we change or add to the court's list of placement types, whether those will affect 4E funding. I am personally convinced, based on years of experience, legal research, that they will not. But we remain willing to work with DHS up till the final moment till we can to resolve those issues. I believe this is very carefully drafted in a way that will have absolutely no effect on 4E funding. Thank you very much.
Could you clarify for the record the difference in effect between reasonable efforts and diligent efforts?
Reasonable efforts is a creature of federal statute. Federal statute requires that the court make a determination about whether the state agency has made a reasonable effort to prevent a child from coming into foster care. And that was added to the federal statutes in about 1980 because it was clear that the financial incentives were to put kids in foster care and not to make efforts and to provide services to keep them out. So it's a federal requirement. There are two other federal reasonable efforts. One is to return the child. So reasonable effort to keep them from coming into foster care, reasonable effort to return them once they're there, and then lastly, a reasonable effort to promote permanence, to implement the permanent plan. Diligent efforts, where we put it in the statute, has to do with once the child is already in the care of the state. So we think a heightened burden applies at that point. Once the state is actually has your custody, has your physical being, we think that more than reasonable efforts ought to be made to place you with someone you know, with your aunt, with your sister, and that's, I mean, it is very clearly and intentional on our part to change that standard.
I wanted that on the record. Thank you very
much.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. When I met with Juvenile Rights Project on this bill and in our work group, we discussed that, and I liked diligent efforts, but we were told we're creating new art around a new term, and I'd like to hear from Judge Waller if indeed she considers that to be a fact, or is there enough there that people are going to understand the new terminology?
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Nan Waller, and I am the chief family law judge in Multnomah County. I've been a judicial officer in juvenile court for 18 years in Multnomah County and have a responsibility for hundreds, if not thousands, of children. And in that work, I would say that we are very equipped and required by both the federal statute and the state statutes to define and interpret all sorts of language. There is not a definition of reasonable efforts. There is not a definition of active efforts. However, over the course of years, those have been defined. I like the term diligent, and I like it because it is the focus on what children need. and we should have a higher level of focus when we are looking at children's needs and those things that they need in order to not only survive their time in foster care, but as with all of our children, to thrive. And from my perspective of 18 years of experience, Senate Bill 282 is workable. It's based upon research, and it is workable. It takes those tasks that judges are used to doing, making findings, making determinations as to what's in a child's best interest, in order to be able to craft a plan that will meet not only the family's needs, but assure that the child, during the time that they are our responsibility, that their needs are being met and not damaged. And I want to apologize. I had a total technology glitch this morning where all of my testimony is someplace in cyberspace, including the emails I sent to Kingsley Click. So I apologize. But I do feel that this is a bill that will, it takes us to the next step in terms of our responsibility for children for whom we have jurisdiction. It requires that we make specific findings as to numbers of school placements, numbers of foster care placements, numbers of visits, numbers of face-to-face contacts with caseworkers, and then it requires that we look at whether the frequency of those visits, placements, schools attended, meets the child's developmental needs and is in their best interest. And that's a prospective child-focused determination, which I think is very appropriate when we are dealing with foster children for whom we have responsibility. I have children who I am sorry to say have had 20-plus foster care placements during their time involved in the court and under my responsibility. And that's because we often look in hindsight at what has happened to a child when we see that things are not going well. This is a prompt. The requirement of findings are prompts that will require that the court look also prospectively and keep track of what is occurring, and I think that that is very appropriate. That was kind of a long answer. I apologize.
Thank you. I like the term. I thought it was a higher standard. I just want to make sure it wasn't going to mess up the folks in the system as far as comprehension.
We're in the business of defining and interpreting, and I think that we have that ability to do right with this term.
Thank you.
Just a grammatical correction for the record. I can't help it. I'm a former editor, but I think the word you were looking for from Blacks was sedulous, not sedulous.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. I read it aloud to my husband. That was the best I could come up with.
I'm sorry, I can't help myself.
That impressed me.
Okay. Judge Waller, did you have
the only other thing that I really wanted to emphasize was I'm sure that there is some question about increasing permanency hearings, which right now we must hold on an annual basis for every child who is within the jurisdiction of the court. This is a fairly small number of children for whom we would increase the number of permanency hearings. They are children whose parental rights have been terminated and for whom we have made a promise that we will find an adoptive placement. And we all know that the window of opportunity for children for us to seek adoptive placements closes quickly as they age. So increasing that higher look at what's going on in terms of implementing a permanent plan for them to every 6 months, I think, is an appropriate look because it increases the urgency that we have to work under in dealing with children who are legal orphans, as Angela indicated. So I think that that's a very important piece of this. There's a piece of the legislation that allows the court to go back and vacate a termination judgment. And I think that is, it is important to define. We may actually already in another part of the statute have that authority already because we can vacate judgments. However, articulating and making it clear that we have that authority, I think will be helpful because there are children for whom we are unable to find adoptive placements and some family connection, even if we are not going to reunite, is important to every child that I have had in front of me who asks when am I going to have a family? And I'm going to take 1 minute to tell you why I think this heightened urgency for children whose rights have been terminated. I had a child who rights were terminated. The hoped-for adoptive placement fell through. And this child was, I believe he was 8 at the time. And the caseworker, marvelous caseworker, doing very good work, was having a difficult time finding an adoptive placement, and time was going by. The child came to her and said, do you think that you could take another picture of me? Could you take another picture of me? Because maybe I wasn't cute enough in the first picture that you sent out to people hoping to find a family for me. So our children recognize what waiting is and the urgency of trying to appeal to others to find a forever home for them. The tag of that story is that the caseworker was able to find a home, and when the child looked at the life storybook, said, I will have a wonderful life. And the last report from this week is he is having a wonderful life. So the urgency is important because it does get results for the children that we need to make sure that we are taken care of. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing that story, too.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Maggie Miller, Executive Director of the Citizens Crime Commission in Portland, Oregon. The Citizens Crime Commission is a nonprofit citizens organization founded in 1988. And for almost two decades, the commission has provided leadership in the fight against crime by working with businesses, citizens, government officials to make Oregon State and local public system, safety system more efficient, effective, and accountable. And we continue to strive for a balance between prevention, intervention, and incarceration. And as part of that mission, the Crime Commission organized a homeless youth prevention task force in 2004 to look at the issues of why such high numbers of foster kids were ending up on the streets in our communities. It was reported that almost 41% of the youth showing up for services in Portland, Oregon were from the foster care system. Because of the findings of our task force, the Crime Commission continues to partnership with the Juvenile Rights Project to sponsor legislation that we believe would help prevent foster kids from becoming homeless. The existence of homeless teens is unhealthy for the community in that it breeds illicit activity. Many youth on the streets sell and use drugs, prostitute to survive, and commit many of the livability crimes in our communities. These youth may also transition from the homeless youth culture into the adult homeless youth culture, homeless culture, and ultimately become part of the very expensive criminal justice system. And that's why I'm here today. The Citizens Crime Commission enthusiastically endorses Senate Bill 282. We have every reason to believe, based on the research available to us, that more attention we pay to these matters, the more successful the children in our foster care system will be, and more our communities will benefit as a result. We must focus our attention and invest our resources wisely to ensure that abused and neglected children experience stability in their lives, to preserve their relationships with extended family, and to ensure that children finish school. Therefore, we urge your support for Senate Bill 282. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Kate Turan. Madam Chair, members of the committee, can you hear me?
Okay. We can.
For the record, I am Kate Turan, President, CEO of Volunteers of America, Oregon. We're one of Oregon's largest human service organizations. And I'm here to talk in support of Senate Bill 282, not so much in terms of the how-tos of this bill, but the why. And I think what is trying to be accomplished in this bill, as I read it, is the highest quality of care for children who are in a system because the state has made the decision they should be removed from their home, own home. And when the state, whether it's Child Protective Services, law enforcement, or the court, makes the decision to remove a child from the home, the state has the highest obligation to ensure that the parenting provided, be it through kinship care or foster care, is of that same quality. And I believe we can achieve that by first looking to the agency to ensure that the planning, the monitoring, and the management of that casework happens according to a standard that allows the child to be safe, to allow the child to be protected, and to allow the child to move on with progress in their lives. I heartily support Senate Bill 282 because I remember all too well what it was like when I was head of the agency when children didn't get that kind of care and support. I knew all too well what it was like for foster parents when they didn't have that kind of support, and all too well from relatives who couldn't afford to take care of the children they wanted to take care of. So conceptually, I think this is a fine direction for the state, and I heartily endorse Senate Bill 282.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Senator Brown.
Thank you. Actually, Madam Chair, if I can go back to Judge Waller, please.
Absolutely.
Thank
and
you.
And anyone on the panel.
Okay. Judge Waller, on page, looks like page 7 of the bill, I think it's section 5 and 6, requires in removal that the court make written findings as to whether the department made diligent efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question for you, and folks have expressed concern about the impact on the judicial branch of being required to make these findings. I guess I want to get your perspective whether this is a reasonable burden in light of the other findings you're making at that point in time, or whether this is, you know, this is going to take a lot more time and energy and therefore have a fiscal impact. So I'm just asking your thoughts.
I suppose every time we put pen to paper or open our mouths, there's a fiscal impact. But we are in the business of making findings, and when it is about children and their well-being and what will work better, requiring the findings is the prompt to the agency to do the looking, and I think that that's, you know, that that's well worth it and part of our responsibility to children. So I would not see it as something that, one, we are, quite frankly, we are very good at creating forms that help us both in the prompting and reducing the amount of time that we are spent actually writing.
Thank you. Madam Chair, follow-up.
Please.
And then on page 12 of the bill, in section, must be section 12, talking about the post-termination findings, I think the other concern has been addressed about more permanency hearings when the child's parental rights have been terminated. I guess my question for you is, do you see this adding substantial burdens on the court system? And I guess a second question to that is, my recollection is we're talking about less than 500 children probably in this number, so it's a pretty small number of kids.
It is a very small number of children, but in terms of ultimate fiscal impact for our state, for those children who drift through post-termination, non-adoption, it surpasses what we could possibly imagine, because they are children who are often the ones that we are reading about in terms of aging out of our foster care system and not doing very well in terms of completion of education, involvement in the criminal justice system. Children who simply don't have that level of permanency or connection to a family, we know the outcomes are not good. So, I see it as probably a very small number of cases. We do a good job in the majority of cases in getting children into adoptive placements quickly, or in the first instance before even getting there, and returning children to parents. So we're really talking about a fairly small number of cases. And for those children, given what is at stake for them, it is, I think, invaluable to have that extra hearing in order to stay on top of what is occurring with them.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First off, it's good to see you, Ms. Tran. You're looking well, I think, in your job. I agree with you very much.
Thank you.
I was always, committee, rather embarrassed by things that happened in the past. And not just in my life, so
we'll let it go at that.
But my relationship with Ms. Tran when she was working for the state, I think, was a very good one, and I appreciated the work we did together. But back to this bill, section 13 on page 12, bottom of page 12, we're talking about considering vacating the termination. I'm assuming at this point that that is an extreme measure, because the termination itself is not lightly done. So
it is an extreme measure. However, for children who we've not been able to find an adoptive placement, we have seen that sometimes returning to or trying to locate biological parents. In fact, I just recently, a child who, after 4 years in an out-of-state adoptive placement where the potential adoptive parents refuse to finalize and the other state recommended disruption of the adoptive placement, the child was brought back to Oregon, separated from a sibling, clearly not in very good shape. The agency on its own went and located the mother, discovered that she had, in the 6 years since termination, really turned her life around, and that child is now placed with her as a foster care placement because her rights were terminated, and we'll see where we come out. But we often locate parents for this very small group, luckily for us, a very relatively small group of children. We often look for those family connections even after, you know, years after termination because of the recognition of the importance of some family connection for them.
Just follow up, I guess, and I understand that, and it's an interesting case, but, you know, if parental rights have been terminated, I guess I'm wondering how many would actually, parents would actually be able to get their lives turned around from being that egregious in a 12-month period.
I doubt that this would probably occur, I mean, after 12 months. It gives the possibility, but I doubt that in most cases it would be occurring after 12 months. These are the cases that that things have gone wrong. The cases that I can think of where the agency is looking for family, biologic family, are cases where adoptive children have been in adoptive placements, have not gotten to finalization, and have not been able to find then another adoptive placement, and sometimes it will not be a return to the custody of the parents, but it will be a child knowing that they in fact have a parent who has some responsibility in their life.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we go to our next panel, I want to let everyone know that we've been joined on the dais by Representative Krieger, who is one of the members of the work group that has been working on these issues throughout the interim. So we are now, Senator Byer, we are now outnumbered by work group members. And we also have to testify today Tina Kotek, Representative Tina Kotek. And Representative Krieger, if you wanted to join her and say something, or if you just want to be a member of the panel. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for waiting. Thank you for having me. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek. I'm the state representative for House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. I'll be brief. I passed around some comments for you. I'm here to add my voice to the chorus in support of Senate Bill 282, and I want to thank you for taking up the issues that you're addressing in this bill, and I hear a series of bills that are coming on the foster care system. We have a unique opportunity to strengthen our system, and I, for one, am looking very forward to seeing your bills over on the House side. I've just stepped away from the Ways and Means Committee. I serve on the Human Services Subcommittee, and what I would say is that I hope that you will pass on legislation based on the policy, and even if there is some fiscals attached to them, maybe let us prioritize them over in Ways and Means. I'm particularly interested in the equalizing between how we pay relative and non-relative foster parents. What I like about this bill is if you take parts of it, it's very supported by research, and we as the state have an obligation as essentially the parents of the children in foster care to take good care of them. And I think this is a strong step, and our goal over in Ways and Means is to provide those resources to actually do this for the workers, for the courts, for everyone who wants to see our system get strengthened. I just want to say thank you for doing this and hope that you will pass on 282 over to the House.
Thank you very much for coming. Back to work.
I will. Thank you so much.
Questions of Representative Kotek? Thank you very much, Tina. Okay, our next panel will be Dr. Kirk Wolf, Amanda McFarlane, Debbie Sharp. I guess that's just three. Well, you're all set for St. Patrick's Day when it comes.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you. You can go ahead and get started.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Kirk Wolf. I'm a child psychiatrist practicing in the public sector in Portland and have been involved in some statewide efforts on youth suicide prevention and on children's mental health. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak in full support for Senate Bill 282. And this is on behalf of the Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatrists, the Oregon Psychiatric Association, and the Oregon Medical Association. I've had a chance to personally treat several hundred foster children, and roughly about 30% of the children that I treat are in the foster care system. And for a number of reasons, foster children lead a childhood of struggles. And again, this happens for several reasons. And I am in firm belief that this bill will make a very important difference in helping foster children in Oregon get more of the stability that they really need. I find it helpful to consider what it means to be a foster child. And what it may mean is that during the pregnancy, they may have been exposed to alcohol and drugs. And in fact, this may have led to some brain damage, potentially. It often means that in early life, there is neglect, physical abuse, and or sexual abuse. To be a foster child means to lose very important connections with parents, brothers, sisters, relatives, schools, neighborhoods. And over time, they are at greater risk for significant depression and or anxiety, suicide attempts, dropping out of school, abusing alcohol or drugs later in life, increased health care problems and costs, as well as poverty. Realistically, being a foster child can mean lifelong struggles. I personally find it helpful to think about the challenges that we all experience in our lives. And when I look back and when others look back, it's really family and friends that help us get through the tough times. And foster children have tougher times saying that. They don't have that support that they really need with their family and friends. Realistically, children need meaningful connections for healthy development. And Senate Bill 282 focuses on these connections and helps to provide stability for foster children by promoting diligent efforts to place with a close personal relative. Again, that connection is very, very important. Placement with brothers and sisters, that's very, very important. More frequent visits with parents and siblings, trying to maintain that connection. More frequent visits with his or her caseworker, and really greater accountability with permanency hearings. So on a personal level for foster children, this is a very important bill. I can also speak in my efforts as part of the Children's System Advisory Committee, which is helping to transform kids' mental health. We're going to need many more placements than we have. And I can think of some kids that have ended up in residential care at a cost of roughly $260 a day, average length of stay about 4 months. We're talking an incredible amount of money for kids that, some of these kids, if they had better placement with relatives, maintain a connection with brothers and sisters, that some of these kids could have been maintained in the community and not needed residential care. So I think on a personal level and a financial level, this is a very important bill to support. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today in support of Senate Bill 282. You'll be supporting the foster children in our state with the passage of this bill.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
You're next, I think. You're signed up next. Is that Amanda? Yes.
My name is Amanda McFarlane. I am 16, and I am from Gresham, Oregon. And my brother, my sister, and I have been in foster care for the past 11 years. And me and my sister went into foster care together, and we were there for about 6 years. We only got to see my brother for maybe 10 times out of the whole time we were there. And my sister now is somewhere psychiatrically hospitalized, and my brother is out of foster care. And just, I think that if they would have left my brother, me and my sister in the same home, that it wouldn't have turned out as bad as it has. And every time my sister, like, if I don't see her for like a month, then she gets worse. So she has to have like, chance to see me and my brother like once a month. My brother and sister are really, really important to me. And I miss them, and so they weren't really a part of my life growing up. And I think that we really could have all been more stable if my brother was put with us. Or even regular visitation would have helped. So, yeah. Thank you.
Amanda, thank you so much for coming. Are you in school now? Where are you in school, and what year are you?
I am a junior.
You're a junior in Gresham? Gresham Barlow?
Reynolds.
Reynolds High School. Having a good experience there?
Yeah.
That's good. Well, thank you so much for coming, because, you know, we sit here in this room and try to make decisions, but someone who has to live with those decisions is a very powerful witness. So you've done a good service today. Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, Chairman Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Debbie Sharp. I am a former foster parent and an adoptive parent, and I'm also president of Parenting Connections, the RAFT, which is a new support group for foster, adoptive, and relative care families. And I'm here today to urge you to honor existing attachments in the lives of our foster children. These attachments come in various forms, obviously attachments to their parents, their grandparents, siblings, extended family, close family, friends, and peer groups. Each time an attachment is compromised, the emotional well-being of the child is damaged. Often this damage is irreparable. My first foster child was one of a sibling group of four. Each one of the children, for very good reasons, was placed in separate placements. But they had a comprehensive visitation plan. While mom was doing the things that she needed to do, the siblings were learning to have a more functional relationship that would allow them all to go home. Several months after she went home, I took in sisters ages 5 and 15. When the reunification plan collapsed, several plans were discussed that would result in separation of the sisters. One of the alternative plans was for me to adopt the youngest and the older sister to be moved to Arizona with her biological father, with whom she had no relationship. Thankfully, this did not happen, and I was able to adopt both of them. I honor their attachments to their families by allowing them as much contact as is appropriate and in their best interest. This bill asks you to honor attachments. At times, we need to look at the attachments that are the strongest and healthiest and honor those. As director of our support group, I hear stories of children being removed from stable placements because there's a newborn sibling, and that blood relationship is put at a higher priority than the existing attachment to foster parents. While I believe that existing sibling relationships need to take a very high priority, simply being a sibling should not take priority over the best interest of the child. There are cases such as care needs, extreme emotional issues, or lack of existing relationship where the better option may be separate placement, but with as frequent of contact as possible. In our support group, I have also become aware of the extreme needs of some of our grandparents. One case in point is a couple in their early 50s who are foster parents to their three grandchildren. As grandparents, they do not receive foster care reimbursement. This has been a huge financial drain. To compound this, the grandmother has had to quit her job to take care of these kids and their special needs. These factors put a strain on their marriage and, in reality, put the placement in jeopardy. They request that I ask you to honor them as foster parents with the same rights and responsibilities as regular foster parents, including foster care reimbursement and training. Additionally, many years ago, I watched as my cousin and his wife took in their two nieces for a year or two. They were great foster parents and would have made excellent adoptive parents. However, they were unable to continue to provide financial support for two additional children in their family, and so the children were adopted out of state. About 12 years later, the oldest turned 18 and started having more contact with the birth family. Clearly, she has some significant attachment issues, and I wonder if those issues could have been lessened had she been able to maintain relationships with her biological family. The key factor in this not happening was the financial inability to add two additional children to their young family. I ask you today to honor attachments and do whatever possible to keep those attachments intact. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your testimony, and I'd like to ask Amanda a question. It says in your written testimony that you lived with your grandmother first, and I don't know if you know or not, but if you do know, was that terminated, or did that cease to exist because of financial reasons also?
No, my grandma got sick.
Oh, okay.
Sadly.
Thank you.
Senator Brown.
Thank you. Another question for Amanda, if she doesn't mind. Could you talk about how many different foster placements you've been in and how many schools you've attended?
I've been in 11 different foster placements and 9 different schools.
11 placements.
How many schools?
9.
And how old were you, Amanda? I have your testimony. I just haven't had a chance to look it over carefully, so forgive me if I'm asking something that's already in here. But how old were you when you went into foster care the first time?
I was 6.
And your sister is older?
My sister is 3 years younger.
3 years younger, I see. Well, you did a good job today. Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you very much. Okay. Next panel, Kathy Kaufman, Molly Rogers.
Right, but there's no motion connection.
Welcome.
Well, it's going to focus on close personal relationships as opposed to. Well, this is
welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Kaufman, and I'm the policy director for Children First for Oregon. We are a statewide, nonprofit, nonpartisan child advocacy organization. We've been around for 15 years, and we believe that every child in this state has a right to be healthy, safe, and secure. For most of those 15 years, we've been publishing an annual report card on the status of kids in the state. And in the last few years, we've grown increasingly concerned about the grade that we've had to assign the child welfare category. The most recent grade for 2006 is a D. I'm here to say that Children First for Oregon could not support Senate Bill 282 more strongly. We think that this is an excellent first start at improving our child welfare system and our foster care system, and we believe that the goals of this bill are the right ones. The importance of stability for children, for all children, but especially children who've experienced abuse or neglect, cannot be overemphasized. Research tells us that placement with kin, placement with relatives, is more likely to be stable. And yet current practice and policy in the state means that fewer children are placed with relatives than might be. 48 other states are ahead of us in recognizing that there is no reason for there to be disparity between payments to relative foster parents and non-relative foster parents. It's imperative that Oregon join those other 48 states. As researchers from the National Child Welfare Resource Center for Organizational Improvement recently noted about Oregon's system in a report they released a month ago, families stay in the system longer and safety is difficult, if not impossible, to assure. For that to be said about a system that is in place to protect children is very discouraging. One of the components of Senate Bill 282 that we are most pleased to see are requirements for caseworkers to document how many face-to-face visits they've had with children who are in foster care. The evidence is clear that face-to-face contact is the most significant factor in ensuring safety for children who are in out-of-home placements. We also are pleased to see that the bill is doing more to encourage contact with parents, siblings, and extended family, as other folks have testified, have spoken to. Maintaining family bonds is also important to child outcomes. And those kind of family contacts also work to increase stability, reduce behavioral problems, and even work to improve the chance that a child will be able to be reunified with parents. So, in conclusion, we think Senate Bill 282 is the right bill, and we think now is the right time, and we urge all of you and all of Oregon's lawmakers to support this bill. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you for coming. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity for allowing us public testimony today. My name is Molly Rogers, and I'm representing myself today as a member of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. And we are in support also of Senate Bill 282. The Oregon Commission on Children and Families, in an effort to address major issues related to children and families, looked at the local comprehensive plans developed by each of the 36 counties across the state of Oregon over the past few years, and issues of the foster care system rose to the top across 90% of those plans, and were addressed in all of them. We had the opportunity to really work on this as an Oregon State Commission and delve into it, and we also support the philosophy and the policy behind 282 that focuses on relationships and continuity and maintaining the attachments. It has very important implications for foster children. The sections referring to maintaining familial relationships and sibling stability will have a profound effect on children being removed. The numbers of children in foster care range from 7,700 up to a little over 10,000. We've asked PSU to kind of look into that and get the more accurate numbers for us. But between those numbers, it's still a significant number of children in Oregon that are not sleeping in their own homes, not sleeping in their own beds each night. When we took this up, we asked in February, we knew the research was there behind the number of placements and the negative correlation then to finding permanency for children. In February, we asked and were presented at a dinner dialogue with Dr. Catherine Kahn from Portland State University, and presented her information also. That really, the question was, is our system in crisis, and if so, what to do about it? The connection also is between crossover children in dependency and delinquency. My other role is I'm the Wasco County Department of Youth Services director. And in 1 year, in 2004, in Wasco County, 44% of our delinquency caseload had previous dependency out-of-home placements. And nationwide, the numbers run between 65 and 67% of dependency crossover kids that are both in the dependency and delinquency system. So in February of 2006, we met with Dr. Catherine Kahn, and she presented to us about the connecting of the familial relationships and maintaining those, and looking for kin to come forward and provide services and stability for the families. That we're not ever going to build our way out of the foster care system by recruiting more foster homes. That there's just an ever-ending need and not ever going to meet the supply doing it that way. And so looking at it from a different perspective made sense. And as a state commission, we took the time to really mull that over and had the discussion. And Senate Bill 282 meets the needs. It starts looking at a different perspective towards foster care and putting the children's needs, developmental, emotional, and physical needs, kind of looking at it through a different prism. The other piece of that presentation at the time was reconnecting youth, which 60 Minutes did a presentation on Kevin Campbell, who over the past, I think approximately 8 years, 3,000 children have been reconnected. These are the most hopeless, in many cases, children who are deep in the foster care system, who have had many placement changes, many placements, and through the process of reconnecting youth, family members have been located. And approximately 25% of those young people are in some sort of living arrangement with those family members. Another 50% have connections with family members. Doesn't necessarily mean a living placement, but visitation, holidays, even just corresponding with the young person. That presentation stayed with me. As I look back in my years of sitting in the courtroom presenting to the judge on placement decisions for both delinquency and dependency cases and first removal of dependency cases for children who are abused and neglected, and looking into the gallery and finding many natural supports that are actually at that point willing to step forward and not having really the tools, the agency really not having the tools to access that support. Senate Bill 282 gives us the tools as well as the policy direction to do that. The statement in 282 that I think is profound is that it's to promote each child's right to safety, stability, and well-being, including the child's right to continuity of relationships with parents, siblings, grandparents, and other relatives is a significant statement to Oregon's children. I think that puts their interests first. As I close, I have a quick analogy, which is it's scary enough for a foster child, any age, to see their family in the rearview window. And it's also scary to lay in someone else's bed, on someone else's pillow, under someone else's blanket. But it's even more scary to see a spider on the ceiling and not know which is worse, calling a stranger to come in and kill it, or watching it and being scared and terrified of it. That's the situation that foster children are often in. And Amanda sitting up here was profound that her courage was able to do that, and I compliment her for testifying in front of you today. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you. Okay, our next panel is Arthur Towers, Derek Wright, Kathy Bayer, and Kathy Grange, I think, or something. You'll correct me, I'm sure.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Arthur Towers, Political Director for Service Employees Union Local 503. Our union represents 36,000 working men and women across the state. I'm proud that among our members are frontline workers who have it in their hearts to work with abused and neglected children and their families. Much of what is in Senate Bill 282 we feel is in current practice. We support many of the laudable goals of the legislation. But we wanted to testify today in order to flag for the committee some issues that are happening within the department's restructure that we're concerned may conflict with the efforts of this legislation. I have with me today several frontline workers to provide their comments on the legislation and on what's going on the front lines.
Hello, my name is Derek Wright. I'm an ongoing caseworker from the Dalles, Oregon.
I'm Kathy Baer, and I'm from the Dalles, Oregon. I'm a social service assistant. I assist the caseworkers in implementing case plans. I do visitations, transportation, and work with clients.
I'm Kathy Granger. I'm a social service assistant from Multnomah County, and I'm attached to the Protective Service Unit.
I'd just like to take a few minutes of your time today. I have reviewed Senate Bill 282, and I'd just like to address several sections. Section 7 on page 8, where it talks about the court ordering visitation between children and parents, and then making the department responsible for developing and implementing a visitation plan consistent with the court orders. Our dependency judges in Wasco County currently do that, and I believe that is a positive thing. And then again on page 12, section 11, it talks about determining what is in the child's best interest based on developmental needs in regards to visits. And currently, I'll just read from a letter I prepared. I've been a child welfare caseworker for the last 4 years in the Dalles, Oregon. During this time, I've seen documentation requirements increase while other services to families stay the same. I currently have a caseload of 17 cases with 31 children throughout the state. The majority of these children do live in Wasco County. However, I do have some that are in Burns and in Salem, Oregon. There is a new proposed reallocation of staff that they're looking at, and what that would do is basically take the current 188 social service assistant positions and reduce them to 96, and then add more caseworkers. However, if they did reduce that one social service assistant position in Wasco County and add one caseworker position, it would not affect my workload at all, except for increase it, due to me being required to supervise more visits. So let me just continue with my paper here. I agree that it is very important for caseworkers to supervise some of the visits between children and care with their parents to fully understand the family dynamics occurring. I usually supervise approximately one visit a month between children and their parents and would be supportive of a policy requiring the standard. If social service assistants lose their jobs, this will have direct impacts on families which the state provides services for. Many of the children I work with are at least 30 minutes away from the location where visits are supervised. Having caseworkers transport children both ways and supervise all of these visits is not a good use of their time. First, it will decrease the visits that a parent and a child have together. Visits are frequently two times a week in Wasco County, but now would need to occur only once per week at the most due to time constraints. If an emergency comes up with the family that I need to attend to, the children who are in foster care will be disappointed because there was not an adult to assist them in their visit for that day of the week. This means instead of children having visits twice a week with their parents, they may miss that one visit for the week because of an emergency they now have to deal with the family, so the child may not see their parents for up to 2 weeks. It was earlier discussed, I believe, in an opening statement that children not having visits with their parents does not facilitate reunification. Visits are a very positive thing between children and their parents. Second, I will have much less time to complete documentation and referrals for services for families due to being in the car, transporting children to and from visits, and supervising these visits.
Mr. Wright, could I break in for a second here?
Yes.
We have your prepared testimony, and we're really interested in comments specifically to the bill.
I think
your comments are more general.
Okay.
Specifically,
Section 7 of page 8 says the department is responsible for developing and implementing a visitation plan consistent with the court's orders. If the court orders visitations occur 2 to 3 times a week and the Department of Human Services eliminates half of their social service assistant positions, caseworkers will not be able to meet the visitation plans which are in the court orders. If they do attempt to meet those visitation plans in the court orders, they will not have time to make referrals for services to parents, such as drug and alcohol referral, parenting referral, writing narratives, attending citizen review boards, because they are now required to drive a child to and from a visit and supervise that visit. So my position as an ongoing caseworker working with the children and families is that it is very vital when you see the new proposed budget come out that social service assistants positions remain.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Baer.
Hi. I am one of those social service assistants, and when I read over this bill, in Wasco County, we meet a lot of these standards already, and we do diligent efforts for relative searches, and the court does order a certain amount of visits. We do, from talking with other caseworkers around the state, we do a lot more visits than other counties do. Sometimes we're doing up to 16 hours of visits with one family a week. I personally am supervising about 19 hours of visits with one family a week.
Do you have specific comments on the bill?
Yeah. I just wanted to talk about the fact that we are trying to implement this. We agree with 282. However, we need to look at staffing requirements for that also.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Granger.
I think that there are two points that I want to make. One of them is that, you know, increasing visitation I think is a good thing. I think that what the agency is trying to do with their restructuring and getting rid of the 95, that's a roundabout figure, social service assistants across the state, is that basically when I work with 15 families, that would be a workload that would fall to the caseworkers. There are specific, particularly in protective services situations, where children have been newly removed from families. A lot of the families we work with are drug involved, and they have a system of denial around the circumstances of the children. When a caseworker comes in and says, you need to change this and make it safe for the children, they don't really want to hear that. And then when they have to face that person in court, there's a lot of feelings of animosity that they'll bring to those interactions with their children. And that's where my job comes in particularly handy. I'm not the person that they face in court. I'm not the person who took their child away.
And can I ask you again, because we're running out of time, do you have comments specific to the bill?
No, it's specific to, you know, the staffing changes.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Senator Burdick, just in closing, again, we're supportive of the concepts behind the bill, but again, we're very concerned that the implementation of the proposed legislation would be very challenging given the changes that are being proposed. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we'll take Debbie Sharp.
Yeah. They're concerned that caseworkers won't be able to move given that there must come between the transport.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was a confusion. Thank you very much. We'll take Kevin George if he's here.
Okay. We should talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, if you can be very, you have prepared testimony, so if you can be very, very brief. We've got a couple of people we got to get on a couple of the other bills.
I think it's pretty.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Kevin George, and I work as the Foster Care Program Manager at the Department of Human Services. I hope you've been able to appreciate the the degree you've heard from other presenters around the commitment from the judiciary, the commitment from community partners, the commitment from caseworkers, around how important it is to continue to talk about foster children. And 10 years ago, we certainly wouldn't have been talking at this level and trying to move practice even further. So I appreciate the time and attention towards this. Today I want to actually provide you two different documents. One is a fairly long-winded analysis of each of the sections within the bill because of the complexity of that. And then I provided for you just a cover letter, which that's what I would like to just go over on a higher level at this point in time. Department of Human Services and Juvenile Rights Projects have worked together for a number of years in order to enhance services to children and families in the child welfare system. We appreciate the Juvenile Rights Project's continued efforts at prodding and pushing and working with us as we go along. Senate Bill 282 is a good example of the positive ideas, and it is a very comprehensive piece of legislation. There are many things that are policy, and it actually supports the department's vision in many ways of trying to strengthen child welfare delivery of services and also in keeping children safe in Oregon. What is important to think about in this, though, is in the context of the larger picture. The department at this point in time, as you've been hearing, is working towards a new safety intervention model of where we'll have caseworkers in order to keep children safe, increase our practice and our policies to be more consistent in price and in precise so that we can actually provide a better service to children. We do offer a variety of recommendations and have been supported by Juvenile Rights Project as we've been rewriting our rules, and they've provided us they've provided us many comments on the rule revisions. The governor is investing in the resources for additional caseworkers, for legal representation, for more addiction and treatment services for our families in the system, and all this enhances the child welfare system and the foster care system specifically, and it's parallel to what is covered in Senate Bill 282. I noted that I have provided you written testimony, and I wanted to make sure that we understand that there are many things in here that the department supports, the concept behind it, the practice behind it, and much of the concepts in whole. But we also appreciate the fact that there is a fiscal impact on some of the elements within the bill.
You think?
And I would like to be able to identify about three different areas. One is that under the first area that I'd like to talk about is the relative payment piece under Section 1. It is a concept that we have continued to try to support, and fortunately we're able to bring forward a package this year through the governor's recommended budget to be able to provide relative payments for foster children. The complexity or the difference between our bill, House Bill 2182, and the Juvenile Rights Senate Bill 282 is that we are asking for authority to provide a means test, meaning that we would look at the relative who is not being able to be paid for foster care funds and apply a means test to them and try to determine do they have a fiscal need in order to raise this child. And if so, then we would actually provide that foster care funding. So that is really the difference between our two bills.
Madam Chair, can I ask a couple questions regarding that issue?
Please do.
So I'm just curious, Mr. George, with regards to the means testing piece, sort of the underlying public policy, and that is, having done family law in the past, we don't do a means test on custody orders, and I guess why would you do that for relatives and for foster kids?
Certainly. Chair Burdick, Senator Brown, what we are talking about is, in terms of foster care funding, is a federal program that comes into the state, allows us to pay Title IV-E funding for those children who are eligible. For those children who are not eligible and are placed with a stranger, a non-related person, the state then comes forward and looks at, do we have any other funding? And if not, we use state general fund dollars for a non-related provider. What our bill tries to address, and so does Senate Bill 282, is that for a child coming into the foster care system who is not eligible for the federal funding and we place with a relative, currently we have prohibitions in our system that allows us to provide state general funds. So what we're asking for is the ability to provide state general fund dollars for those children in a relative placement. And it's really what we do for non-relatives at this point in time, but it's actually asking for permission to be able to do that. And as you've heard about 7 or 8 times already today, 48 other states already do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
In addition, we believe that the importance of siblings, strengthening siblings is very, very important, and we believe that the direction that the Juvenile Rights Project is heading is good. We believe that there may be some other choices of language on how to define that more common lay language may be of assistance. Second, and probably the most concern we have at this point in time,
Madam Chair, before we go there, I'm assuming you're referring to diligent, the term, right?
Senator Burdick and or Chair Burdick and Senator Cruz, actually, the term we're having some challenges with on this time right now is the word affinity.
It's on page 5.
Trying to identify the affinity of a sibling, and how that actually plays into deciding who is your sibling and who is not. Now, I've tried to look for loopholes because I've got a few siblings that I would choose to maybe not have, but no. I digress.
Okay.
Thank you. The next piece that we're really talking about is that, and many folks have testified theoretically, conceptually, passionately, over and over today about the importance of relative placements. And we too believe in the relative placements, and we too want to continue to support that. And we believe when we get into the real specifics of this bill around Section 6, we believe that the relative preference placement statute that has been on the books for some time and we continue to try to strive for actually opens the door wider by using other persons known to that child. Other persons known to that child are very important, but if it's in the same statute where we start then competing a relative towards somebody else who knows this child, that's where the department has raised issue with the Juvenile Rights Project and said, is this really what's important? Or if we're going to have relatives as very important, then they should be the one and only in a statute when we're talking about relative preference and not other people who actually know the child as well.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're on page 6 of the bill, first couple of sections there, Mr. George. And I guess my question for you is, and I appreciate your focus on relatives' rights, and I think we've really seen a transition in the law over the last 20 years in terms of this issue. But really, shouldn't the focus be on the child here and the child's needs? And so I guess my comment would, this is not about relatives' rights. Isn't this about what's in the best interest of the child, and shouldn't the relationships that the child have come first over, you know, relatives and all that other stuff?
Chair Burdick, Senator Brown, if I misspoke, I must have misspoke. What I was trying to speak to is Section 6 and not page 6. And Section 6 actually expands the current statute of relatives, others defined by law, to put in other persons. And I appreciate the fact that it is important for kids to know who it is that they're going to be with, but when it comes to the point of putting a relative against somebody else who happens to know the child, and that could be broadly defined as somebody is the daycare provider, the teacher, the coach, somebody who knows this child against a grandma, I think that's where we back up and say we need to have relative preference first. If and after that does not happen, then let's look at all these other folks, but have a hierarchy in place.
Madam Chair.
Senator Brown.
Thank you. I actually think that's back to my point, and that is if you've got a child, and I think Dr. Wolf would be happy to come up and back me up on this, but if you've got a child who's got a very close relationship with whether it's a baseball coach, a daycare provider, et cetera, versus an auntie living in, heaven forbid, Florida, that the child has never seen, that the more important relationship in that child's life is the baseball coach or the daycare provider versus the auntie he's never seen, and that the focus should be, and the court is, I think, very capable of making this finding, is the focus should be on the child's needs in this circumstance, not on, you know, which relative has the closest, you know, relative ties.
Yeah.
Chair Burdick, Senator Brown, I can appreciate the comments, and what I'm trying to respond to is certainly the direction that we've had out of federal law, the state's position, direction from the legislature around looking at relatives first and foremost first, then move to other people. And so I'm responding to that direction we've received on a number of occasions.
Okay. Thank you.
The next component within the area that we struggle with is in terms of, we've also heard testimony, and there is research that backs this up, around the importance of face-to-face contact with caseworkers, with children, and with the families on a regular basis. And we believe certain elements of the bill actually prohibit or will impact the caseworker's ability to spend more time with the kids by requiring them to spend more time documenting and increasing the reporting requirements to the court to make certain determinations and findings, but it actually limits the caseworker's ability to actually spend time with the children. The third area that I would say is that we believe there will be a fiscal impact, and clearly the primary part of the fiscal impact is in paying all the relatives, and that comes no surprise to this group, I would assume by now. And we understand the fact that with the governor's recommended budget and approval of the child welfare practices, that some of the funding and fiscal impact will be offset by what's already built into the governor's recommended budget. So in closing, I would say then that in summary, DHS looks forward to continue working relationship with the Juvenile Rights Project and other advocates around caring for Oregon's children. We believe that collectively we are all making a good impact and we're heading in the right direction. Clearly we have at times where we don't agree. We have differences of opinion, and that'll continue to happen. And I think that's a healthy dynamic in our system that we will all continue to strive for and challenge one another. And that it's important to understand that these enhancements will be a part of the child welfare services package if indeed that is approved. I'd be happy to answer any more questions you might have on Senate Bill 282, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Of course, I have another one.
No one else does.
Okay, one more question.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Burdick. Page 10, Section 10, the requirements regarding report, and I'm really appreciative of the agency's package and the movement toward what I would call more effective casework. And I guess my concern is, doesn't it seem appropriate for an agency who's acting as the child's parent to at least have a sense of whether the child is getting credits towards moving towards graduation and education requirements that are just so very basic in today's global economy?
Chair Burdick, Senator Brown, absolutely correct. And I would say that the department has been moving towards increasing the responsibility of us and accountability on educational pursuits for kids and for foster children. And the biggest effort one could look at right now is our new administrative rules on educational policy, and that we have now put in a prioritization to say what we believe is most important is the high school diploma. Not an alternative school, not a GED, but actually strive for the high school diploma. And in doing so, then, you have to measure high school credits. The challenge of this ends up being is that, as most of you know, there are 197 school districts. And when I identify with the Department of Education to say, what is the requirement for high school credits, the response I get back from administrative rules and theirs is that there is 22, the minimum number is 22 high school credits with a identification of science, math, and all that kind of stuff. 2 years from now, it'll be different. The caveat being, though, an individual school district has the ability to have different sets of criteria, different credits. So in essence, we may be challenged with looking at high school credits that look in one school district being 22 is the high school graduation requirement. Another school district might be 23 or 24 in another. And that's a challenge, I think, within the system. When we start putting this stuff into statute and into current law, that's where it gets bogged down. Is it appropriate for Judge Waller and others to ask questions about educational pursuit? Absolutely. But if we're requiring
credits,
the importance to say that this child, 14 years old, has 2 credits, 4 credits, 5 credits, we need to understand how it is that it translates into the high school requirement. Are they on track? Should we anticipate that?
Okay, we'll put into one thing. Okay, thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you. Very quickly, Maura Roach. In committee, while she's coming up here, I'm going to open public hearing on 2 of the next bills just to hear one witness each who came down for the day, and then we'll put the rest of the bills over, rest of the testimony on those bills and the other bill over till Wednesday. So I know people have to go to committees, so stay as long as you can. I will stay here myself as a subcommittee until we're done. Welcome to the committee, Maura.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maura Roach, and I'm the lobbyist for the National Association of Social Workers, Oregon Chapter. I'm providing testimony today from Christine Nelson, who is the Dean of the Graduate School of Social Work at Portland State University and has 40 years' experience in child welfare issues. I will hit a few highlights. I will not read the entire testimony. I know the committee has it before you. Simply to say that financial support for relatives, the vast majority of whom are low income, will make relative foster care more possible in the state of Oregon. And that's why we support Senate Bill 282, because it would correct a fundamental contradiction in our state child welfare system, which on the one hand designates foster care with relatives as the first and best option to consider, but on the other hand doesn't provide the financial support to make that possible for some families. The failure to provide foster care support payments to some relatives also has significant ramifications for ethnic minority children who are overrepresented in Oregon's foster care system, as they are in foster care systems across the country. The rate of kinship care is higher among African American and Native American families in particular, so these families are disproportionately affected by policies that govern relative foster care. Ongoing connections to siblings and extended family members, such as grandparents, aunts, and uncles, bolster children's well-being. Children who remain in the care of family members are less likely to move from home to home. Such placement stability helps protect children against a number of undesirable outcomes, such as emotional disturbance or school failure, which are in turn risk factors for outcomes such as poverty, homelessness, and criminal justice involvement in adulthood. As Oregon's child welfare system struggles along with systems across the country to serve thousands of children in need of assistance in the face of significant resource limitations, it's important to focus on approaches that are likely to produce success. On behalf of Oregon NASW, I urge you to support this approach and pass Senate Bill 282.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you, Maura. Okay, I'm going to open a hearing on Senate Bill 328, Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 328 comes to you from the request of the Senate and Judiciary Committee for the Oregon Law Commission. Allows juvenile panel of the Psychiatric Security Review Board to direct the Department of Human Services to place youth under the panel's jurisdiction in specific type of facility or direct specific care if the panel determines that the current placement is inappropriate, has to create substantial danger to the youth, and does several other things, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Okay. Okay. We'll take only one witness, and Julie McFarlane, and also invite you back on Wednesday if you want to, Julie, to say more, but I wanted to get you in and out of here today. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, and I appreciate you getting me in. I do have a court hearing tomorrow afternoon, so I won't be able, or Wednesday afternoon, so I won't be able to return. I was a member of the Juvenile Code work group on.
Can you put your name on the record, Julie?
Oh, I'm sorry, Julie McFarlane, and I'm a supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. A member of the sub-work committee on this, particularly towards the end of the, in preparation for the session. And I wanted to make sure that the committee was aware of sort of the defense bar's position on this bill, which is that we support it. And I also did speak to Ann Christian today from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and she is ill, but she wanted me to make sure that I let the committee know that the OCDLA supports this bill as well. This is an important defense, and I'm sure that you will recall during last session we established the juvenile PSRB for children with mental health issues who qualified for the defense, and an exception was left in the bill for children who would otherwise qualify under constitutional law because of a mental defect or mental retardation. And so it was our attempt during the interim to address and make the provisions of the bill that we got passed last time applicable to that group as well. And I think that, you know, what defense attorneys see in representing these youth in juvenile court is that judges are reluctant to grant this defense because there is not a clear plan for the youth once they are found to not be responsible by means because of the mental defect. because there isn't anything like the juvenile PSRB to supervise them. And so we have more kids who are not getting the defense, and that means that they're going into OIA or the other into juvenile probation, where they're less able to supervise them. And so I would urge the committee to pass this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, Senator Brown?
Just one quick question, just for the record. Ms. McFarland, you noted that judges are reluctant to grant the defense. Isn't it also that defense attorneys are reluctant to assert it because they don't know kind of, there's no sort of system for where the youth might end up?
Senator Burdick, Senator Brown, that's correct. And there is always concern that children could end up hospitalized, and that would, particularly for a mentally retarded child, that would be an inappropriate placement. So we wanted to come up with a system for dealing with those youth in particular.
Thank you. Any other questions, Senator Brown? We're supposed to you now. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, now we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 328 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 325. And for the record, I don't think I ever closed the hearing on Senate Bill 282, so retroactively we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 282. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 325 is at the request of the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee for the Oregon Law Commission, allows an attorney for a parent or guardian to move to withdraw from the dependency matter involving jurisdiction, established permanent guardianship, determining parental rights if the parent or guardian fails to appear at the hearing without reasonable explanation, requires a person ordered to appear in a court dependency matter to personally appear, prohibits a person from having his or her attorney appear instead, allows the court to grant exceptions, requires the appropriate forms to contain a statement that the person must appear personally.
Thank you. And we will take Carmen Brady Wright, and then we'll continue with Wendy Johnson when we continue on Wednesday with this bill. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, and I guess I should say no members of the committee, but Senator Brown. I really appreciate you taking the time to hear me, and I guess I am known for speaking very quickly, so that's a good thing. For the record, my name is Carmen Brady Wright. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Family Law Section of the Department of Justice. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 325. This is a bill that amends the summons statutes for juvenile dependency matters, as well as permanent guardianship and termination of parental rights proceedings under ORS Chapter 419B. I've just provided you with a copy of my written testimony, and I believe that Wendy Johnson with the Oregon Law Commission will be providing you with additional documentation as well. I would just note, just very briefly, as Senator Brown had pointed out, that this did arise from the Oregon Law Commission's Juvenile Code Revision Work Group. Members of the community that is involved in juvenile court practice from a variety of different aspects participated in this work group, including judges from several different counties, the Office of Public Defense Services, the Juvenile Rights Project, private defense attorneys, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, the Oregon Judicial Department, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Human Services. And the members worked very diligently and came to agreement on proposed amendments to the Juvenile Code summons statutes that accomplish essentially three things. The first is to clarify an attorney's authority to move to withdraw as counsel when the attorney's client, the parent or other summoned person, has failed to appear at a mandatory court appearance without reasonable explanation. And that mandatory appearance is related to a petition to establish jurisdiction, permanent guardianship, or termination of parental rights. And it further clarifies the juvenile court's authority to grant the motion under those circumstances. There was concern noted by the work group about inconsistency statewide in terms of how to handle mandatory appearances when summoned or ordered to appear, parents and other persons did not appear. And while the rules of professional conduct do address an attorney's ethical obligations in terms of when they're required to or when they may move to withdraw as counsel, the work group felt that it would further clarify juvenile court practice for both the practitioners, the parents, and the courts to include these provisions in the statute. The second thing that these amendments do is to clarify that when a person is summoned or ordered to personally appear at a hearing related to a jurisdictional permanent guardianship or termination of parental rights petition, that person may not appear through counsel. I will note that it provides an exception for the child at issue in the proceeding. A child who's 12 years of age or older is required to be served with a summons for a jurisdictional hearing. That is not a requirement for a permanent guardianship or termination of parental rights petition proceeding. So there is an exception for the child at issue in the proceeding in that situation, and they may appear through counsel. The third thing that these proposed amendments do is that they clarify in the summons and orders to appear that with permission obtained from the court in advance of the hearing, the person or parent may appear by other means, either by telephonic means or by other electronic means, which all I can think of would be video teleconferencing. I would just note, as you're looking through the bill, I think as you're looking at it, it can appear very repetitive, and that is because the Section 1 is the provision that it allows for attorney withdrawal provisions in the court's authority. The next three sections address summons and orders to appear in jurisdictional hearings. The next three sections address summons and orders to appear in permanent guardianship or termination of parental rights proceedings. And so in order to be consistent, you'll see the same language through each section. Because this is a cleanup bill and there are many technical changes to these statutes, I, of course, haven't gone through each and every section of this bill word by word. So I guess I would just conclude by respectfully urging this committee to pass Senate Bill 325. I think it goes a long way in assisting parents and other persons involved in the juvenile court system, as well as courts, DHS, and juvenile court practitioners, by further clarifying juvenile court practice in relation to the issuance of summons and orders to appear and the handling of juvenile court hearings where a personal appearance by a parent is required. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thanks. Senator Brown, do you have any questions?
I don't. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
We will now close the public hearing on Senate Bill 325, and we will move Senate Bill 325, 328, and 457 to the Wednesday agenda. So I'll see you all back then. Senate Judiciary is adjourned.
Thank you. Sorry, Wendy didn't let me know, and I kind of forgot today was a